if I'm not having a good day, you can see it in them and they're mirroring that and they're not having a great day. So just knowing that I have that balance and always staying on top of the balance, I think is important. And sometimes it's really hard. It's a lot easier said than done, but it's something that I'm really trying to do. And I think that's really helped me.
I think there's always this feeling that you have so many things on your to-do list that feel like they need to be done like immediately.
Welcome to the Braemar Life Skills Academy podcast, where we'll explore the evolving world of education and student well-being. I'm your host, Mike Helsby, and in season two, we're focused on personal well-being, self-regulation, and innovative learning strategies for school and everyday life. Whether you're an educator, parent, student, or education thinker, this podcast is for you. Join us for insightful discussions, valuable perspectives, and a fresh look at the future of learning. Let's take that step into the future of education together. Welcome back to another episode of the Braemar Life Skills Academy, Season 2. I'm very pleased to be joined today by a few of my colleagues here at UBC, and indeed turning into fast friends. Timmy, Ravina, and James are going to be talking to us today right in the middle of our episode cycle on resilience. Now, these folks are not just finding the need for resilience in their own life as we work through a busy term schedule at UBC. As you'll soon find out, they are also working on resilience with students in the primary and post-secondary settings. I'm going to let them explain what that looks like in just a moment. But a little background on each of them. Ravina is a grade 3 or 4 teacher. She is motivated by the difference she makes in the students' lives, teaching them to be joyful, curious, and confident in themselves. Ravina has a passion for social-emotional learning and building acceptance and connection in her classroom through the everyday kindness she gives to her students. James, to my right, is a grade 5-6 teacher. Like me, he was born in Ontario, but he's currently living in Squamish, BC. He first fell in love with teaching at summer camps, including a summer spent abroad at an international summer camp in Switzerland. Here, he experienced firsthand the joys and responsibilities of working in a seemingly chaotic situation with children from around the world. And he soon found out that this, quote, circus-like atmosphere is indeed where he thrives. Last, certainly not least, we've got Timmy across from me. Timmy currently works as a student success coordinator at a private college. Timmy's journey as an educator began with working with students struggling to thrive in the conventional school system. This experience laid the foundation for his current role, where he's been able to put connection and relationship first by giving students the confidence they need to succeed. Timmy is passionate about student-first learning and believes in sharing his own successes and failures to help students see that all of them can reach their potential. Hoping to hear some of that sharing about successes and failures, especially in the world of well-being and resilience today. Folks, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here with me.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Ravina, I guess I'll start with you, directly across the table. Sorry to put you on the spot, but let's just start with the background. Where did your education journey begin? What are your early memories from that? And how did it evolve into your position as an educator today and someone looking to expand their career doing some graduate work in education as well?
Yeah, okay. So I started getting into the idea of teaching and wanting to be a teacher later on into my university career. So it wasn't something that I thought I was going to do when I was little, and it was a passion I had all along. It was something I actually developed when I was working with young kids at my job at the YMCA, and I realized that I could really make a big difference in the lives of kids just by being kind, helping them be a little bit more confident, and really having someone that just listens to them. And with that, I realized I was super passionate about working with children, so I started diving a little bit more into that, volunteering in schools, going back to my own elementary school because I had such an awesome experience there. Mm. So I decided to go and see and try that out and just absolutely fell in love with education. I went through my university career just following that passion. And when I went into my bachelor's of ed here at UBC, I realized it was something I absolutely loved, something I really wanted to get into and dive into. And as I've been teaching for the last 5 years, I've really been into social emotional learning and having that at the forefront of my teaching and seeing that as something that's very important for all my students to have. And I've been a big advocate for it ever since. I've been leading my school in social emotional learning and been trying to help other teachers bring that into their classrooms. And it's something that I've really been focusing on as I'm doing my master's, and I'm doing it in special ed with a focus in inclusive education. So I feel like that really ties in all of my passions.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Ravina also teaches Timmy and I so much about social emotional learning all the time.
I really try. Yeah.
She asks us about our feelings.
Like, how are you doing today?
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, we laugh about this stuff, but it is the stuff of education, right? Like, how, I remember walking into classrooms when I was young and not being asked those questions, right? Never having my wellness really checked in on. So it's, I mean, one of the many reasons, along with you just being really fun people to hang out with, that I invited you on the podcast is because I think you put this social emotional aspect first, and I think it's directly connected to the outcomes that we're seeing in student, both academic and their personal well-being today. Mm-hmm. Timmy, your bio kind of features a lot of the same directions that Ravina's does. You talk about instilling students with confidence, being a student first educator. Tell us about where that started with you and what it looks like today.
Yeah, I think for me, it really started I'll start it this way. So when I was around 12 years old or so, I had some struggles throughout my academic journey. And my parents started to notice that just what was happening in the classroom just wasn't really working for me. So basically, they found this person. I don't know where they found her or how they found her. But they basically brought her into my life.
TimmyHelpers.com.
But it was basically, I called her my mentor. Mm-hmm. So I had this person from around 12 years old all the way till I graduated high school. And I think she really showed me what it meant to just feel accepted and have somebody who was really in your corner and to also just be there along your side. Like, I would see her maybe twice a week since like 12 till 18. So having this like consistent figure that's like outside of your immediate family is pretty powerful, and somebody who actually shows this like attention and willingness to like grow with you and learn with you is like pretty incredible. So I think that kind of planted the seeds for me, and just kind of how I like to perceive and how I like to move through the world. But it wasn't until probably after my undergrad, I came back to Vancouver and just reconnected with this person. And I got connected with the family. They started to just, they just wanted me to spend some time with their children and just hang out with them and just make a connection with their kids. And one thing led to another, but eventually they just kind of asked if I would be willing to work more in an academic context. And then basically that's kind of where the educational aspect came in. But what I noticed was this family gave me this chance that they were like, well, you have a really great relationship with my children, so why not build on top of that with some academic stuff? And so from there, it turned into this kind of like, it kind of, I guess, set ignition or set fire to where I kind of moved into alternative learning and homeschool education. And from there, that's kind of where it just kind of exploded for me, was just this student first approach where I started to take what I had learned from my mentor and I started to just bring it into all of the different families I was working with. And as much as I was teaching academic content or supplementing them and acting like a tutor for them or whatever it was very much always student first. It was very much like, let's first make a connection. I always emphasize that I need to make a relationship with the student first and to actually know that I care about them before I can actually get into the learning with them. And so that's really where that all kind of came from.
Yeah. And you're doing similar work as a student services or student success rather coordinator right now?
Yeah. So now I've stepped away from that homeschool alternative learning side of things, but a lot of what I've taken from that and grown from the last 5 years or so, I've now moved into this role called the student success coordinator. And essentially I'm taking a lot of the same approaches, but I'm now given, I guess, some opportunity to now kind of bring those perspectives, but into a more of a school-wide approach. And it's been really interesting trying to take something that I used to work so one-on-one, so privately, so intimately with these students into such a bigger school system, into a bigger setting. And so that's kind of where I've been trying to navigate that. But again, it's still that same approach though, which is student first, right? Student connection first, then which student success can then be built upon. And that's really my position and my approach to learning.
Yeah. The ideas, you've done a nice job of surfacing them and highlighting them. I certainly don't need to do any more, but of putting you say student first, but it does sound like even before you think of these people as students, you're thinking of them as beings, as mm-hmm. as beings that need support, trust, to be understood, to be recognized, to feel as though they matter. And that what we're learning in our classes, certainly, I think what we're experiencing as teachers and students is that relational piece, it's not just a good idea to situate it as foundational. It is naturally foundational. Like the student who doesn't feel as though they are understood or as though they can trust that instructor or that guide, or perhaps they're a mentor or a coach, just isn't going to learn from them, right? Like there's too many oppositional forces at work there. So I love that you've built a career out of that approach to young people.
Yeah.
That's wicked. And James, you were sort of first switched on to teaching in that camp context where I think that relational dynamic is a bit more available, right? You're not just sitting in a classroom with a certain amount of time to learn a certain amount of content as it's been in the past, but you're spending full days, I think, in natural settings a lot of the time with young people. Was that your experience there? And then how has that translated into your life as an educator?
Yeah, because teaching and camp counseling is, I think the core difference there is that when you're a teacher, you can have fun, but you have this curriculum that you need to get done and you need to cover. But camp environments, the only goal that you have is that you just want to have the kids having fun. So the stuff you can get away with is much more, because at the end of the day, if the kids are smiling, it's like it doesn't really matter what you did. So I kind of fell in love with the working with kids at camps. My first experience was when I was 18. So I got hired for this day camp. It was back in my hometown of Collingwood, Ontario.
Close to Blue Mountain.
Yeah, they're close to Blue Mountain. And it was like this bike camp. So the kids would bike around town and we'd go to parks and we'd go swimming. But it was basically like the counselors would get together at the beginning of the day and we're like, okay, where do we want to bike? What do we want to do there? And then we just like fill a day. Like it was totally open-ended. So I remember I had this good relationship with one of the other counselors. He was, so I was 18, he was 26 at the time, and he was actually a full-time teacher. And I hadn't even considered teaching up to this point, but because I actually worked with some teachers, they were the ones that actually got me into like thinking about it, because it hadn't even crossed my mind to be a teacher. But it was really funny. So this guy, my friend who's 26, so him and I had a good relationship, and we started doing these games at camp where, in the mornings we'd have all this free time. And so all the young kids I would take to do, what I called ninja training. So we were right beside a park, and, at this park, there's like swing sets and slides. And like, so I'd take them and do like little ninja challenges. So I'd say, okay, you have to climb up this pole, then go down this slide, and then you got your ninja level one, right? And then I'd say ninja level worm. That was the first level. And then they do like a series of challenges. I had 30 little 8-year-olds doing this training, and then go like ninja level parrot, ninja level elephant. And then they're like working their way up, and they're just doing like just challenges I'm coming up with on the spot. Like seriously, one of them was jumping off the swing set and is like, oh, you got your ninja level eagle. And then so Mike noticed this whole thing. And he's like, I had done this over a couple of days. Like the kids were getting super into it. I had all the little kids, but at this camp, there was also some older kids that were not as much into it. So Mike actually noticed this. And so he recruited the older kids and he said, we're going to do Spartan training. And so his training was like, they had to do push-ups in the sand and like army crawl. And like, it was like, not even like fun. And so he had about like 7 or 8 of these older kids who were like, again, like 11, 12, 13, like big kids. But I had like 30 of these little nuggets that I had made my ninjas. So eventually this escalated over the course of the week. Cause again, we had like no plan. Like we're just kind of making stuff up as we go. And Mike and I are like, you know, training our little armies. And then eventually it got to the point where, you know, we're going to have a battle with our two armies. And so, we're kind of like, Mike and I were kind of like, how far is this going to go? So I took my ninjas into the trees and we're going to do like ambush scenario. And then Mike had his in a nice little tight phalanx of these big kids. And they walked into the trees and all my little kids like jumped on them. And it's like fun play fighting. Like it's not like actual fighting. But then like 5-10 minutes goes by and it's starting to get like a little aggressive. Like I see kids like hanging off of the big kids' necks. Like you see kids getting tossed. And then like both Mike and I kind of look at each other across the field. We're like, well, this is not going well. And so eventually it reached a natural climax in the battle where, kids are, brawling all over. And this one little kid, his name was Cannon, which was very fitting, like loose cannon.
What a name.
Oh, yeah, Cannon. And so Cannon was neither a ninja nor a Spartan. He was just a loose cannon. And so Cannon had actually run up from my side of the battlefield, okay, at camp. And he had run up to Mike and he had just punched him in the valuables. And so Mike goes down and he cannot believe that I had sent a kid to do this because that's like, it's crossing a line. And so he sent a kid across enemy lines to then punch me in the valuables. So both Mike and I are laying on the ground, full adults. We have kids brawling around us. The head counselor comes over. And he's like, what the heck is going on? And he kind of like closed down the
education.
Whole thing. Education. Yeah. So at the end of the day, come away from this whole experience. No kids were hurt. It was all like fun and games. But yeah, that's like at the end of a day at camp, you can be like, oh, what we do today, we had fun. The kids are going to, they loved it. If you spent the day at school saying I trained ninjas to go fight, older kids, so you couldn't get away with that.
Tough one to justify.
Tough one to justify. Yeah.
But I think we sometimes use the word fun as like a dismissive sort of silly word, almost as though it's the opposite of learning or what should be happening in a classroom. But like nobody who's not well has fun. Nobody who doesn't feel like they belong has fun. Nobody who doesn't feel like a certain sense of purpose and involvement and self-esteem is having fun. Fun is a deceptively, I think, interesting concept. If you can generate it in the lives of students, I guarantee you those kids remembered that experience with you and Mike at camp.
Yeah.
Right? Like, if you could have inserted a few maybe self-regulation tools or some social emotional exposure learning, I think you've got
necks.
Just about the perfect lesson, right? But we so often like, no, there's no room or time for physical activity in the classroom, right? There's no room or time for a physical interaction in the classroom, right? Like these kids actually coming in contact with one another and having a sort of unstructured play with one another. Increasingly, studies are showing like that is the stuff of the priming of learning, right? Like that's the best position you can put a young person in and then deliver something that maybe they're going to be tested on or maybe is going to develop into one of those career skills, which is, I think, maybe problematically positioned as the end of learning, but it is certainly an outcome that we wish for along with and fundamentally well-being. So I think we've got a lot of really shared experiences and certainly a shared perspective on like what comes first in the lives of students and what our first job is when it comes to those younger folks that are in our care. Ravina, heading back to you, in your primary classroom, you got grade 3s and 4s?
Yes.
Okay, and we're heading into the winter break right now, which is not always a time of the tightest discipline and the most productivity, as any educator is familiar with, and well, it shouldn't be. What are you doing in your classroom and what are you seeing in your classroom in regards to maintaining that state of well-being, that state of belonging, community, which we know is always going to come before any good learning that takes place?
Yeah, so at the start of every school year, like all of September, essentially, we spend on social emotional learning. So talking about students' feelings, emotions, regulation. We also do a lot of talking about the brain and how their brain works in relation to emotions, feelings. So as we're moving through these next couple of months, they always have that at the forefront of their education and of their academic learning. So we move into December, a lot of it is prepping for our winter concert, making gingerbread houses, making all these winter decorations around our school. We're doing a lot of things that aren't very structured academically. And I think having that SEL at the forefront of it really helps the students stay regulated during these times because it can get a little bit, or it can look a little bit chaotic. It's like a controlled chaos. So I know what's going on. The students know what's going on. But if someone's walking by our classroom, they'll look in there and be like, what is going on in that room. We have Christmas music playing.
Is there a teacher in there?
Yeah, is there a teacher in there? Like, I'm like, yeah, I'm like making all the artwork with them. We're singing these songs and it looks like chaos. But when you get in there, the students are very regulated. They have their emotions regulated. They're able to, if they need a break from that situation, they're able to talk about needing a break and kind of walk to, we have a calm down corner. So they can walk to that calm down corner, play with their fidgets, do some mindful breathing, and then come back into the context. So I think laying out that forefront of social emotional learning and naming our emotions at the beginning of the year really helps in these times where it's not as structured or doesn't look as structured as it would have been in October, November. So I think that was a big thing that really allowed my students to be in this state of chaos, but also feel like they have control.
When you're doing your planning for like maybe longer term or midterm planning, do you think of those sort of longer term ebbs and flows in energy and organization? Like, as you just sort of alluded to, September is kind of the time when you lay the groundwork, and then there's a sort of rise in expectations, but that has to be met by also a proportionate sort of waning and reflective period, and maybe have a bit more chaos and a bit more quote unquote fun in the classroom. Is that in your mind early September?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So you need to start planning for December and then also for January, because January is essentially like starting over again. Those students have had 2 weeks of break where they may not have had the same type of learning happening at home or the same type of conversations happening at home. So it's essentially starting all over and getting those students back to that groundwork that you tried to develop in September. And then again, it rises and they're doing super well. And then you get into March around spring break time. And the same thing, it can seem a little bit chaotic and a little bit disorganized. And then you come back in April and you're laying out that framework again. So I think it's a lot of ups and downs and you need to plan for that. If you don't plan for that in September, you're going to come into December being like, what's going on? How do I control this? How do I handle this situation?
Yeah. Man, I think that's so intuitive and important. We can get tricked into thinking of a year of school or maybe even a career in school as being a fairly linear progression, just heading up the mountain the whole way. I think it's so much more accurate, so much more in keeping with the rhythms of the body to see those sort of those wave-like ebbs and flows in energy. James, you're working with a group of kids who's just a little tiny bit older than Ravina's grade 5-6.
I was actually just thinking, as Ravina was talking about those cycles throughout the year, that it actually changes depending on what age as well, too, because I find because I teach grade 5-6. So my grade 6s are right on the cusp of that, like, you know, the puberty age where the attitude starts coming out. So a lot of grades, I think the kind of cycle through, like I think Ravina captured it well, like kind of the cycles throughout the year. But definitely towards the end of the year, I've heard a lot of teachers say that, like, you've got things dialed in, like the kids are like, so they know all the expectations, the routines, and things are just like, just flying. Yeah. But I find for grade sixes, the end of the year is actually one of the worst times of year because they're right on the cusp of like graduation. So they're like, I'm not even going to be at the school anymore. They're, you know, they're growing up. They don't think you're as cool anymore. so that hurts. but yeah, so it is interesting. There's definitely cycles throughout the year of like harder times and then times when I do find like December is a good time because everyone's like super excited for the holidays. And so I think that helps that you can feel the excitement in the building.
Yeah. And you can, I think, make use of that excitement to build community, if not building like really highly regulated learning situations. But I think another important piece, Ravina, that you mentioned is recognizing, as we all were forced to during the pandemic, that these kids are going home, these students are going home to very, very different situations. Some situations that are quite literally yanking them out of any of those regulatory dynamics that may have been building up in the classroom. And 2 weeks it doesn't seem like a long time, but boy, you come back in January, it feels like it's been a lifetime away. And some of
even
these
a weekend sometimes is a long time. You're like Friday, things are dialed. Monday, it's like, we forgot it all.
And then a long weekend, like a 3-day weekend. That's a lot.
But that's where these cycles come in, right? Like we're not just, well, we learned chapter one last week, so now we're doing chapter two this week. It's a constant referral back to those foundations, right? And I love that about SEL, right? If you always go person first, you never have to worry about what was forgotten, right? Because it's them, right? It's them in participation, in context with their community. Timmy, you're working with some folks who are a little bit older than grades three to sixes, but do you see those same sort of fluctuations in energy levels depending on the time of year?
So I've only been at this college for the first semester. So I've only been there for one semester. So I'm actually learning a lot about those cycles and those ebbs and flows right now. Like I really haven't, I can't speak towards any patterns or anything I've observed yet, just because I'm going through it myself right now, actually. Mm-hmm. Like I am learning what the cycles look like and what these ebbs and flows look like in this college. Even speaking to that though, like it is interesting. Like I do feel like I'm learning alongside these students that I'm learning about, right? Like this whole, I came into the intention this semester with the idea of observation. Although I want to go in there and I really want to, you know, try to implement whatever I'm thinking about with student-centered approaches or human-centered approaches, even in this aspect, and just trying to connect with students first. I really wanted to go in just to understand what the landscape currently looks like in the first place. So I really went in with just observation. So it's been a lot of just like talking with students, getting to know them, understanding their stories, understanding what they're dealing with, just trying to figure out like what they're dealing with first before I bring anything up. But funny enough, though, of course, that's me trying to make connections with the students naturally. Mm-hmm. But it is interesting. Like right now we're heading into the end of the semester. It's final exam week right now. These are college kids, so you can anticipate it's extremely stressful right now in the college. Yeah. Like it is
a bit different from gingerbread cookies and
So it's pressure. Hey. Okay, you know what?
You eat enough of those, that's pretty stressful.
You don't know the kind of gingerbread cookies these two are making.
You never had that terrible icing trying to build a gingerbread house and it's just not sticking and it just keeps falling.
You've never had it flying across the room, it's in your hair, and you're like, how did it get you?
It's actually the same, yeah. So gingerbread houses, second year sociology courses.
Same thing.
But I'll even argue though, like, I mean, to be fair, like, they're older, but I always believed in this idea that like whatever that child or that adult is feeling is just as pressing in both each other, like just matters just as equally. So if it's gingerbread houses or it's a second year sociology exam or whatever it is, the what they're feeling is just as valid in each situation. Mm-hmm. And I've always thought of that with like this human student-centered approach, because like at the end of the day, if this child I'm working with is feeling this way, like that's valid. Like I probably felt like that when I was their age about maybe their sticker collection getting ruined. I don't know why that was my example, but that's
a hard thing.
That is a hard thing, yeah. Right? Like, but that's a thing that happens to them, and they will respond just as if we were to respond to our own version of stress. And so I think that like that idea of, even if it's like, we're all experiencing our own versions of whatever a stressful situation could be, but it's just different for everybody. Yeah. But the response still remains the same. Mm-hmm. And I think that like going back to it, so it's like final exam week now. And so all these students are of course like super stressed. So like there's always a level of like right now for me, I'm finding that I'm doing a lot of just validating. Just like, I acknowledge that you're stressed. Like I get it. Like this is what is happening right now. And it is a stressful time. But then, of course, it's acknowledging that and, again, having them feel heard and accepted and being patient with that so that they can then move forward into whatever's next.
I should have had you on the podcast with Dr. Suna last week. And for the folks who haven't checked it out, please do. It's a good primer, especially for what Timmy was just saying. Dr. Suna, who's been studying resilience for however many decades, had some really, really interesting takes on where it comes from and how to maintain it. Firstly, totally in keeping with what you just said, and really surprising to me, according to her studies, dozens and dozens of schools, this has ended up being the case, what is most predictive of resilience and well-being in any given classroom is the relative resilience and well-being of the instructor or of the regulator, right? In the past, both my parents are educators. They kind of informed my attitude towards education. I've seen a lot of really, really good educators adopt this sort of sacrificial attitude where they're willing to totally drain the tank, right? Like to put themselves into negative health states or to put themselves into exhaustion and high anxiety in the name of maintaining whatever sort of classroom environment they want to maintain. But as I think you said earlier on, paying attention to your own sort of internal regulation is an important piece in making sure that you're able to approach these students the way that they deserve. And then, of course, that second piece, totally echoed by Dr. Suna as well, insisting on showing each person that you interact with, each learner that you interact with, that they matter and that they matter on their terms, that the things that matter to them are in fact important, right? I think especially working with younger year students, you see this a lot, like stickers, toys, little, you know, a hair clip can seem like nothing to us. Why are you letting that distract you from the important learning that we're doing in this classroom? But those things can be everything to that student. We don't know. That could be their symbol for safety. That could be like the thing that that makes them feel like they've still got their kind of parental care around them, right? I've seen this in my own students. We had a young fella when I was teaching in England whose behavior was radically shifted when he was just allowed to bring one of his favorite things from home and just have it sat on his desk each day. In the past, I would have said, how could this possibly move the meter on his sense of well-being or on his learning, but it ended up being so influential. I want to kind of zoom out on that concept of well-being and to kind of see how it's working both in the lives of your students, obviously a nice range or age range of students, but also in yourselves, to relating to that point about keeping ourselves as instructors and as people who are sort of designing these learning environments. What are you doing in this very sort of transitional, cold, dark, heading towards the holidays time to keep yourself well and to make sure that you're ready to show those young people that they matter every day?
I think my biggest thing is making sure that I have a balance in my life. So I told myself before I started coming back to school that if I was going to do this, I needed to have a balance. So it couldn't just be go to work, go to school, go home, go to sleep, and then do it again. I knew I wanted that balance. I want time, like things that make me happy, being outside, being athletic, playing sports, being with my friends and family, things like that. That's what I want to be doing. Like, I don't want to not be able to work out or not be able to hang out with my family and friends, because then I feel like I get more stressed and overwhelmed. And then I'm translating that into my classroom. And the kids are seeing that. Like, they smell fear. They know when you're not having a good day.
Yeah, it's so true.
So if I'm not having a good day, you can see it in them. And they're mirroring that and they're not having a great day. So just knowing that I have that balance and always staying on top of the balance, I think is important. And sometimes it's really hard. It's a lot easier said than done, but it's something that I'm really trying to do. And I think that's really helped me.
I think there's always this feeling that you have so many things on your to-do list that feel like they need to be done like immediately. And I think what you realize when you actually try to keep this balance, you say, no, I need to take a break from teaching tonight and take care of myself, like go to the gym or like go do something with friends, like something that doesn't involve 12-year-olds. Yeah. And I think when you actually take that break and you're like, okay, I had all these things I need to get done. You come in the next year, like, I did not need to get done those things. Like those, like half of those things were not even necessary. These things I can easily now see a better way to do it because I've given myself that space to be creative. Because I think you get into this panic mode where you just get laser focused on this like to-do list that just grows like exponentially. And it's only when you're able to like take care of yourself that you're able to think of other solutions that are much better. Yeah.
I agree. I think I think there's a level too, like everybody's saying, like it's important to create balance, and I'm in total agreement with that. And I think that even what you're saying is like, I've always believed that if like taking that extra moment for yourself is super important, because at the end of the day, if you're able to go better and your well-being is better for yourself, you'll be able to actually provide more for your students in the long run, right? Like it's, it's a long, like, I don't, like, sometimes I feel like we can get really stuck on like the short term vision rather than the long-term vision we have for our students. And I think that's even for ourselves, like we get really honed in on like, I don't know, I'm guilty of looking at like semester or like semester by semester rather than like a full year or so with these students, right? Like it's just, I think that's really important, is just to try to maintain that bigger picture goal you have, and that reminding yourself that like these moments for myself are actually for myself so that I can be okay, so then I can be okay for my students in the long run. And I think even also, like, you're right, Ramin, like it's hard to stay like on it all the time. And there are many times where we also feel our own ebbs and flows. But I think it's also really powerful when you can just acknowledge that you're going through those ebbs and flows also when you're before even going into the workroom or like workplace or whatever it is. It's just because like there's going to be days where we're feeling low and we need to acknowledge that so that we can move forward into the day and how that's going to maybe influence our day. But at least it gives us a chance to label what's happening throughout our day. And like, it's kind of like, oh, that's kind of why I responded that way. But you know, you're responding that way because you've acknowledged it already. And I think that in itself is something we even try to exemplify to our kids, right? Like we're trying to teach to our students that it's okay to acknowledge what you're feeling and it can influence how your day is going to go. And so I think it's the same thing. It's just like it's impossible to be perfect all the time. Like
I think when you tell them that you're actually like, when you're honest that you're having a bad day, like the kids really, because they like these insights into how you're feeling, right? Because you spend so much time with them. And like when you're vulnerable with them and saying, I'm not feeling my best today, like they really appreciate that. I think they have a lot of empathy when you give them the chance.
That's the piece you started with, Timmy, about like approaching this new role over the course of this first semester with humility is so different from, I think, how we're all often encouraged to start new roles or to enter new situations, which is that whole like fake it till you make it idea. I remember walking into my first classroom and feeling like I have to look like I have everything all together, even though like I was terrified, right? Like I don't know if you remember your first time in the classroom. James, you seem like you have such a rapport with students that you probably just walked in and started having fun right away.
I think it was quite clear. I had no idea what I was doing. I remember my first, I'm in my third year of teaching. My first year of teaching was at a private school. So I had a very small class. I only had 10 kids. Seven of them were girls, which was lovely. And then three boys. And I remember we had like a week before we started school for like to prep our class or whatever. My vice principal was like, oh yeah, you should get your math program planned out. And I was like, oh my God, I don't even know what math they learn in this grade. Like I had a grade 6-7 class. I was like, I need to figure out what I'm even like teaching them. And then I remember the first week I was like, we played this game where they were adding decimals and we threw a rubber chicken at the whiteboard at like a target on the whiteboard. Nice. And then there'd be different decimals in the target. So they'd have to add whatever they hit with the rubber chicken. And I kind of looked at this and I was like, I'm teaching math. This is great. But I look back and I'm like, I had no idea. Man, but you just kind of free ball it.
I think there's stuff happening there that like the SEL theorists of our day would really, really encourage and applaud. Attaching a lesson, let's say it's about decimals, to a physical act that is also communal and generates enthusiasm. Like those are the things that are going to code a memory and cause it to stay. Right, sitting in a desk with a textbook, listening to the droning, the sort of Charlie Brown teacher wah-wah-wahing at the front, like that's a great way to make sure you forget everything that's going on in that moment. But throwing a rubber chicken at a wall,
you're not forgetting that.
You'll remember that.
I think even adding on that, like the SEL lens too, and the student connection idea, right? Like, I think what's really cool about it though is that it removes a lot of that math, like content curriculum thing you have to follow. And it really puts the emphasis just back to the student. Like, I remember when I was working in my homeschool and alternative learning role, I always tried to describe it to parents as it's like a journey, right? Like, I'm going to try to teach this curriculum, this content, whatever it may be that they're hoping for me to work on them with them. But I always like prefaced it that like, I don't know everything. Like, I don't know how to teach all of this perfectly. Like, but what I think I'm pretty good at is trying to build a relationship first. So then it becomes more of a journey, because now the relationship I have with my student, we both see it as we're learning together. So rather than me be this like teacher and student role, it's like two people trying to figure it out together, which is really fun, because it's like there's this humility in the teacher. There's this really like humanizing aspect almost, where like your student no longer sees you as like this source and wealth of knowledge. They see you as this human that's trying to figure it out too. But with that though, then it becomes less about the outcome and trying to make sure that they like get this content and like understand
the checkpoints.
It's just like, no, we're going to do this together. We're going to get there somehow together. But it's the work. It's like even just that idea of together, like we're doing this together. And I think that idea of that, like taking a step back with humility and like approaching it being like, let's try this out and let's see what happens. And then everything kind of just grows from there. And you see all the students, and you are all this like you have this like awesome, like, I don't know, what's this word? But like a joint effort, like a joint idea. And you're all just working at the same goals together. And it's like pretty powerful when that happens, because now you're just people hanging out, trying to figure out what to do next together.
And that's just life right there. We're all just people hanging out, trying to figure stuff out together.
But that's the coolest thing, though, is that that removes a lot of the pressures you can feel sometimes. And you're like, we're just going to do this together. And you know what? Wherever we end up is where we end up, but we're doing this together.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think, sorry, I think please. If you're having fun, that doesn't necessarily mean you're not teaching content. Like, I think people a lot of the times think, okay, if they're throwing like a chicken at a whiteboard, they're not learning math. That's not how you learn math. But I'm sure they learned it way better and it stuck way more than another teacher who's teaching it in more traditional sense. And I think a lot of the times we ourselves have that notion of if the kids are having fun, if they're screaming, yelling, running around the room, that means they're not learning anything and you're not hitting that content. But I think the content just naturally comes with it if you're finding ways to get students more engaged and feel like they're having fun instead of just feeling like they're being talked at the whole time.
So I think it's that connection between emotion and learning, and that if you associate something with a positive emotion, you're more likely to keep persisting through challenges and keep at it. And whereas if you have a negative emotion associated with something, you're going to try and avoid it. So
but sounds like somebody had a really good presentation earlier this
week. I heard this one guy. She was just really going off about this topic. He's almost too excited about it.
Speaking of that.
I heard you went half an hour over the time limit on the presentation.
Well, I think that the positive association though, even with that though, it's like, are they having a positive association with the content, or is it a positive association with the people that you're learning with? Right? Like the environment that you're in, right? So like you can be like, I think it's pretty awesome when I get to work with like, again, back my, because I speak more toward my alternative learning and homeschool just because I have more time there than here. But like in my past experience though, I found that like I could jump from concept to concept with some students, because at the end of the day, it was just you and I, like you and I are learning this together. We're working on this together. And maybe I might just have a few tips and tricks to get to where we need to go. And that's where I'll try to facilitate a bit more. But it's the positive association, I think, isn't towards the thing. It's towards the relationship that's there. And again, it's the emotion and learning. But I think it's the positive association with learning together again. So it's not even just with the content. The content is just built on top of that. The people that you're learning with.
Yeah. So I think we're all in complete agreement about the type of setting, environment, attitude that we want to approach learning with. Within that context, what sort of signs are we looking for to determine the students who may be having some negative outcomes? Maybe it's outside the classroom. Maybe they're coming with a lot of baggage from home. You know, maybe it's a bully. Maybe it's something going on online. But we don't get to see inside the black box so often. We get them into these scenarios where we generate as much belonging and community and I think collaborative mutual action towards a shared purpose as possible. And I think that generates a state where maybe some of those signs and symptoms become a bit more obvious. But in your experiences, maybe even this year with the different folks that you're working with, where do you see or how do you see some of those red flags going up? What do they look like in these really great SEL contexts?
I think there's so many ways. I think the number one thing is building a relationship with your students, because you're getting, for the most part, like 30 students that are coming in that you don't know. You don't know anything about their background. You don't know what their interests are. You don't know them. So I think building those relationships, you start to see different patterns. So for example, last year I had a girl in grade 3 and she would come in every Monday, super dysregulated, not wanting to work. And from the outside, it looked a lot like she was just unmotivated. She wanted to be rebellious, didn't want to do the work. And I started to notice that it was happening every single Monday. So I thought it might have to do with something to do with home life, because if you're coming in from the weekend and you're coming in on Monday super dysregulated, it must have something to do with your home life. And eventually building relationships, you're able to find out a little bit more about the students, and it did have something to do with their home life. Mm-hmm. So you kind of build skills that she can use at home. And then there's other students that are dysregulated after they come back from gym, and you realize, okay, maybe it has something to do with gym. Like maybe it's their relationship with the gym teacher or with athletics or whatever they're doing in gym. So you just start to see patterns in your students and start to realize what is it that's setting them off, because they're not just coming in wanting to be dysregulated or wanting to be unmotivated. There's always a reason. And I think sometimes we just dismiss it as, oh, they had a bad day, it'll be fine. Or, oh, they're trying to be rebellious, it'll be fine. There's always a reason why a student feels the way that they feel. And I think as the teacher, it is our job to build those relationships and kind of be able to see what those patterns are.
Are you especially attentive during those transition moments, whether it's from home to school or from physical activity to a more sedentary activity, recess to the classroom? Maybe it's even a nutritive thing, like the kid going and eating a bunch of chips and chocolate bars for lunch and then coming in and trying to settle them down. Yeah,
I think especially for younger kids, maybe for all kids, those transitions are super important, and those transitions are times that lead to dysregulation. So I think being more aware of transitions and how you transition and being mindful of that, I think really helps see how the students are feeling at those times.
Definitely at the younger level too. It's like they don't even realize why they're just like dysregulated. Like as you get older, you can kind of ask the kids like what's going on, and they have an idea of like why they might be acting a certain way. But the really young kids, it's like they come in as a human tornado. And they don't even know why. They're just like, they're just fired up. And you have to know them well enough that you can recognize the reason for them.
Yeah.
Right?
Let me
just frame what you're about to say, I hope.
Sure.
Timmy and I had an interesting conversation right before this podcast, and I kind of joked, like, I wish the microphones were on because the story fits so perfectly with what we're trying to describe here. You were just talking about the power of being able to name what somebody is feeling and almost like attach a handle to something. You were mentioning the amygdala and teaching one of your young fellas about the amygdala. Can you just kind of share that story and how what James just said about helping young people kind of understand what's going on underneath the surface with them?
Yeah. Before I jump into that, I actually was just thinking about Ramina's ideas, and I really did appreciate the fact that it was a step away from looking at the learner as an individual, but looking at the environments around them. I thought that like, that's actually when you asked like kind of where are some red flags, I was like, it's hard because I don't see the students as signaling red flags, but rather perhaps the environments that are around them are causing them to become sensitive. And I think it's really important to actually look at the transitions like you're talking about. And I was like really thinking about that. And I was like, yeah, like it is, about looking not just at the child, but beyond the child and what's going on around them, because they're just responding and like they don't know what they're feeling. But at the end of the day, it's like if we were just to dismiss that as a red flag, I don't think that's very fair to the student. Mm-hmm. I think it's more so seeing like, oh, like what's going on around them that's causing them to now respond this way. But like you were bringing up with the amygdala thing, I had a student. And there were times where he would be going into a situation or coming out of a situation, and it was like super like tornado-y and like really intense. And I was like, whoa, okay, we're feeling this.
Whoa there.
All right.
Something's happening. Whoa there, partner.
Yeah, okay, we're feeling this way right now. Like it's a big, I honestly thought it was a pretty big fear response. And I was like, okay, I was like, what's going on here? And so we started talking more about it, and I brought up the idea of like, I guess the amygdala, which, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's the fight or flight or freeze response that it comes from. And so I found that sometimes what's happening is when students are having this fear-based response, it usually is related probably to them responding to it with their amygdala or their fight or flight or freeze response. And I had explained this to the student, and immediately we started this dialogue around, oh, I'm responding this way because my amygdala is appearing, my amygdala is showing. And we started to label it almost so that when the student was responding this way, we had this common ground and this common understanding that we could like come from and be like, oh, like, is your amygdala acting up, or is this the amygdala or whatever? And my student would be like, yeah, that I think that's what's going on. And then by labeling that, we were able to kind of move forward with strategies and ideas how do we bring yourself back. Maybe we do some mindfulness activities. Maybe we do something like just bring yourself back and just check in so we can get yourself back to regulating rather than acting from this like tornado fear response thing. Mm-hmm. But I think on top of that though, that's just one example of the bigger picture, which is, I think it's really important to give students different like modes of delivery to basically label what their emotions are and what they're feeling in that moment, whether it be a sound, like a physical gesture, a description, literally learning what emotions are and what they mean. Because there's so many ways to express what you're feeling, but it's allowing and giving space and like showing them that there's ways to share that. Mm-hmm. So then when they can share that and label it, then you're able to actually work forward together about how to like mitigate those things and to work through that.
Yeah. And I think it's so important for students to be able to understand that their emotions are valid. Because I think a lot of the time kids are coming in feeling these really big feelings and they don't see other students feeling the feelings or reacting in that way. So if we're able to say like, this is how you name your feeling, this is what you're feeling, and that's okay, I think that really helps just kind of them not feel more isolated. Sometimes they feel isolated in those feelings. But for example, in my class, we have like a feeling chart and they can go up there and they can just point at what they're feeling. There's pictures and words and they can point at it. But when they see, okay, my feeling is on there, they know that it's a valid feeling. It's something that it's okay to feel that. And now how do we move along? How do we move through that feeling? And I think that's so important. And a lot of the times for the little kids, we may dismiss it as, okay, they don't know what they're feeling. They won't be able to name it. They won't be able to acknowledge it, but they can.
Give them the words.
Yeah.
And even that approach has the side benefit of moving emotion out of the realm of the vague, the realm of the unknowable and unquantifiable. Like it feels like you can have so much more control even just by being able to name a part of the brain that's producing a certain sensation or a specific emotion that's generating a behavior set, right? Like that's something that you can get external to and say, it's not all of me that's angry, right? There's a part of me that is generating something like a fear response and that's causing this or that sensation, but it's not me. I'm not bad, right? I'm not as a being defined by this emotion. And when we talk about resilience, I know a lot of theorists kind of conceptualize what resilience is as being something, some sort of series of character traits and lifestyles that revolve around a centered mindfulness. Right? And I know, Timmy, that's a really big part of your approach, kind of getting present, staying present, being present with the people you're learning around, and just kind of recognizing those fluctuating states. We're going to wrap up here in a minute, but I always like to try to wrap these episodes with some practical advice for anyone out there who's a student, a parent, or an educator who may want to bring some more resilience, some more wellness into their life. I think you've already done a wonderful job of sharing some great tips. I think that feeling chart among them, that's something that especially young people can be working with to gain that sort of emotional literacy. But what are you hoping to do? What are you doing already in your personal practice and in your roles as educators to bring things like mindfulness and the states of optimism and gratefulness that come with it in your life and in the lives of your students?
I think the biggest thing I always try to do in the classroom is, forming those connections with the students. And I always try to reflect, because December is a time when I usually try to do like a little gift for the students. So the last couple of years, last year I wrote like a night before Christmas poem, but included all of my kids in it, all the students in it. And it was like this really funny thing. But
I wish you were my teacher.
So I did like, it was like the day before the winter break, and I sat, all the kids were eating snack. Like I sat and I was like, okay, I wrote a poem for you guys. And they're like, oh. And it was like, it was the night before Christmas and all through the school and then went into it. And then I think a really good thing for me to recognize that I'm giving each kid enough attention and connection and really trying to see them is when I can think of an inside joke for every one of my kids.
Yeah.
And if I struggle to do that with any of them, that's telling me that I'm not spending enough face-to-face time with them.
Powerful.
So I think getting to know each kid and making sure that you make time for each kid is just so important.
Yeah, I think just to kind of add off of that, the power of just saying good morning to every student, standing at the door and just saying good morning is huge. Even if they're coming in late, just looking at them and saying, good morning, we're so happy to have you here. You just see them light up. Something I do in my classroom at the end of every day, and now we've started doing it when they leave for recess, when they leave for lunch, is I have a special handshake with every kid. And it's hard at the beginning. I'm like, I can't remember 25 different handshakes, but then you just have
never
that.
Never given Timmy or I a handshake.
Yeah.
What's with that?
We'll figure it out later.
stay tuned for the next iteteration of this podcast. Yeah. We're going to have some handshakes on.
Yeah, we'll show you the handshakes. But it's so cool because whenever they're leaving, they're like, oh, handshake. And then we just do it. And they're so happy about it. And the parents are so excited about the handshakes. And there's other kids around the school that are like, we need handshakes too. And just they're able to see that we have that personal connection. Like we have something that's special. Something else that I just thought of that was really funny. The other day, the kids were asking me who my favorite student is. They're like, who's your favorite? Like, you have to have a favorite. And I was like, I don't have a favorite. You're all special to me for a different reason.
I see you're all my little darlings.
Yeah. And then they're like, why am I special? And I was like, okay, you're special because of this. And then the next one came, well, why am I special? So now I'm like telling all of them. And I was like, okay. Like thinking of it. Yeah. I didn't think they were all going to come running. And so now there's a lineup of kids.
Now you know Timmy and I are going to ask this question.
Yeah. We need some affirmation here.
Yeah, some positive affirmation.
We need some acknowledgement. I guess I think that we've all kind of said our piece on just the acknowledging of children and everything, but I do think what's really important though is something we've already mentioned, but I think it's just doing it for yourself. Like seriously, like as an educator, like half the things that we do for our kids and our students and all these things is super awesome, but I do feel that there's value in like just mm-hmm. doing the same things that like the same activities or the same things that we try to like foster and support and grow within our students is just as valuable for ourselves, because we're also learning, like I've been saying, like we're learning all together. So it's like you might as well do it for yourself and get and like be a part of that too, because if it works for them, it probably works mm-hmm. for you. So mm-hmm. I think that's just something that I always try to take away. It's just like, you know what, like practice what you preach, kind of idea. Yeah. It's like, sometimes I even say to myself, I'm like, if I'm like going through something or I'm like dealing with a stressful situation, I sometimes just say, I'm like, well, what would I tell one of my students right now?
Am I hungry right now?
Yeah.
Am I tired? What's going on?
Yeah. And that's all it takes sometimes. And then again, like then after that, if you're balanced and you're feeling good, then you bring that into the classroom and it all just kind of opens up from there.
Mm-hmm. I think another thing, when you're coming into teaching or you're new to working with students, it can be really overwhelming and you're kind of trying to figure out, where do I start? How do I bring social emotional learning into my classroom? And I think it's important to mention that there's so many programs out there already and so many things that you can use and look at and do research about that can help you implement it into your classroom. So it's not something that you just have to figure out on your own. And you have to make up, like I've used a lot of them in my classroom and there's some really great ones and you just kind of have to figure out what works for your classroom for that year. So I think it can be really overwhelming and difficult, especially as a new teacher, to try to figure out how to put all these things in your classroom. But there are resources out there that you can use that mm-hmm. can help you with
totally.
It.
Totally. Are there any that have worked particularly well for you?
Yeah, I really love the zones of regulation. Mm-hmm. I think it works for any age group, and it's something that you can really implement into your classroom that doesn't take up a lot of time, but it's something that's so impactful. And I also really like the Mind Up curriculums. They're broken up into different grade groups, and they start off by talking about the brain, and we've talked about how important that is, and then it leads to mindfulness strategies, and they have the lessons laid out for you. Just open up the book and you just do the lesson. So you don't even have to come up with it on your own. So those two, I think I've used a lot and I think they're really beneficial.
Mm-hmm. Anything from either of you gents, resources that have really helped you out, especially finding regulation for yourself or translating that into regulation in your classrooms?
So the not specifically related to like social emotional learning, but I think it definitely helps. Number one, with building that connection with students and also creating that positive atmosphere in your classroom. There's a book, I forget the author, but his book is called Teach Like a Pirate, which is a very interesting title. Sounds kind of hokey, but it's actually really interesting. If it's this high school teacher, I think he's in the US, and it's all about all these strategies to make your lessons just super engaging. So it's like using storytelling, using props, using mystery, using like special events in your class, and just making school more than this kind of like mundane experience. Mm-hmm. Like, and one of his famous things from the book that I thought was just so interesting is are there any lessons that you teach that you could sell tickets to? Cool. And I think that's just such a cool idea that you just have some project or some activity you're doing with the kids that you're just so pumped about. And you're just like, the kids are so pumped about that you could just like, you can make them pay to do it.
It's good litmus test.
Cool. Yeah.
No particular resource comes to mind other than like, again, I'm always going to offer something a little alternative here. Okay.
Really? Always the alternative.
Hey, but I'll say that, honestly, I think one of the best resources that all teachers and myself included have access to is actually the students themselves.
Mm.
I think that they bring a lot of just like working with them and actually like just genuinely hearing what their ideas are and trying to actually validate them and work with them. At the end of the day, like they probably will give you more answers than actually what you can figure out for yourself. And I think if you come from that position, it's pretty clear from there.
Mm-hmm. I mean, couldn't have said it better, and I'm not going to add anything else on. There's so many nuggets of wisdom that I think can be taken away from conversations like this. And maybe one of the overriding bits of wisdom is get yourself into conversation with people like these, right? People who are in the same situation as you, understand what you're going through, and have some experiences and some practical takeaways to share. Because I know just sitting with you folks in class the last few months has really given me a lot of positive energy towards changing my pedagogy and kind of updating, especially my approach to the social emotional life of my students. As we've emphasized, folks out there, start with yourself, whether you're a student, a parent, or a teacher, get the internal regulation right so that you can show up for the other people in your life, and then make those relationships foundational to any other goals that you may have for that group. You're never going to get meaningful learning done unless the trust and the openness is established first. I love that that's where we started. I'm pleased to end there. Any final words, any hopes for the future or directions that we might point people in before we go?
No, I mean, thanks for having us.
Go make some gingerbread houses.
Yeah. Go make some gingerbread houses.
And if it doesn't go well, just take deep breaths. Yeah.
And try again.
And just eat it, not as a house.
There you have it. All right. I haven't ended a podcast with gingerbread houses before, so I'm happy to go first time. Hoping to have folks like this back in the future, and maybe exactly these folks later in the year, just to see how things are going and how these perspectives are continuing to develop. Until then, this has been Ravina, Timmy, James, and I'm your host, Mike Helsby. Just looking forward to more conversations like this in the future. Till then.